Well, hello and welcome to the Broken Wharf podcast. My name's John Mark and I'm joined by my co-host,
Johnny Woodrow. Welcome to the Wharf, everybody. Thanks for coming back again. How are you doing, John Mark? You all right?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yes, we've had an interesting week with ill health, haven't we, Johnny, where we suspect we've both come down with the same thing.
I think so, probably. Or I'm getting tension headaches or something. I'm starting to get migraines. But anyway, I'm sure the listeners are not so interested in my headaches as they are the usual things that we talk about. Or I hope they're interested in the things we talk about. They keep coming back, which is nice, isn't it? You know, so,
That's the hope. We've come back for round two on knowledge, haven't we?
Yes, you've titled this on whatever this bit of kit is that we're recording on, Knowledge 2. You didn't call it Knowledge 2, The Revenge.
The
or
return.
Any other kind of sequel kind of theme, you know. Anyway, yes, we wanted to come back and sort of, well, I think we finished off last time in our sort of ramblings about some basic assumptions or ways in which our modern world approaches the problem of knowing the real world. We kicked that around for a little bit, and we thought there's probably a few more things just to say and land on a few things, didn't we? Somewhere towards the end of the last podcast, you said something like, "I think we'll have to come back to this." So we thought we would pretty quickly. So here we are.
We are 1 week later, and we've got more things to consider about knowledge. And maybe a good place to start, Johnny, is to try and partly pick up where we left off and partly take this conversation down a slightly different route too, which is you had a quote for us that helpfully unpacks the question of what does it mean to know a thing, or what's the participatory element of knowing? How about you kick us off with some divulgence on that issue.
Some divulgence. Well, so we talked a lot last time, just to sort of frame this, set this up, about the mind in a vat, or the person who is in the prison cell, this idea of knowledge and things, looking out, disconnected, that's the key idea, disconnected from the world. The world sends a signal, but really we can't really know in our prison cells, separated from the world, if we're really knowing the world or not, which is out there and separate from us. That's the kind of, that comes from Descartes, it comes from Immanuel Kant and those sorts of folks. And so you start with a basic idea of, I've got a doubt, you know, that's Descartes, that the world's, the one thing I do know is that I doubt things, and that turn in our understanding of things being and knowing hasn't set us up very well for living in the world, actually. Now the alternative to the guarantee of truth is how much our minds can compute things that are away from us, the other side of the cell wall or something like that. The alternative to that, and the older version, it's a participatory approach. So if you think, so it's like throwing the doors of the cell open, walking out, walking back to the world and going, actually, I know the world because I'm in it and I participate with things. And I know things because, not because I've decided beforehand to know things, but because the things of the world impose themselves on me all the time. When somebody switches on a light in the morning, you know, they get up slightly earlier than you, and this is my wife, and then she sticks on the big light, and I immediately, and that makes me wake up. I didn't have to think beforehand. I'm going to receive some information, and I'm going to decide, quite separate from the information, that I'm going to see a light. No, the light imposed itself on me through my eyelids, and I just react. There's a fellow called Andrew Davison, who's written a book called Participation in God, A Study in Christian Doctrine and Metaphysics. And towards the end of the book, he starts applying some of the things. This is the quote you were talking about. It's his short quote. He says, a participatory approach to truth. So this is distinct from a kind of what you might say Kant's approach to truth, where we're not participating in things, we're separated from them. A participatory approach to truth is easy to define. Well, that's good news, isn't it? Let's see if the next part of the definition is easy.
Don't you think that should be something that the reader determines?
Yes, probably.
Definition.
Yeah. He should have a footnote. Do let me know if I've achieved this or not. So a participatory approach is easy to define. To know something is to share in it by receiving a likeness from it into ourselves so as to be shaped by it. Just as every creature has its being by participation in God, to know a creature is to participate in that creature. Now, at the basic level, that means something like that you turn on the light in the morning and it wakes you up, or the alarm clock wakes you up. You are the sound, the light, it's at a very basic level. If you're stumbling around in the dark at night to go and get a glass of water and you trip over a chair that's out, you know, sticking out, you participate in the chair. You know, it's matter impacts you. It lends its form to you. It informs your intellect in that sense. In that moment, you go, "Ow, chair! Oh, who left that there?"
And
so, yeah.
And you come to know the chair not only intellectually but also physically.
First of all, you kind of
made impact.
Yeah, yes, that's right. So this is the common sense approach to knowledge that actually we all live with. Right. We are actually all functional realists. But when we stop for a moment and start to think about how do I know anything, we can tend to step away from the common sense approach and start going down some kind of strange Cartesian, Kantian rabbit holes and start to doubt we know anything at all, even as we sit in the chair that we're not deciding is there, but is supporting us to ponder how we might not know anything, you know, that sort of thing. So Descartes sends us on some, and Kant sends us off on this sort of crazed inner trip. I got one just to sort of summarize last time. So the last time we were setting out the non-participatory approach to truth. And this time we just want to explore a bit of that participatory approach to truth. Another quick summary of, okay, this is from a fellow called Etienne Gilson, who does a bit of he uses the word idealism for this, idea that we are separated from the world. And we only know the world, we don't know how we know the world. You start in your exploration of the world by first asking, how do I know anything? And that's the wrong move. How do we explore truth? Don't start, first of all, by going, well, before I get to truth and real things, how do I even know anything at all? That move means you're never actually going to get there because you already start from doubting I can know truth. That's the problem. And Etienne Gilson calls that idealism. And he says, indeed, all idealism derives from Descartes or from Kant or from both together. And whatever other distinguishing features a system may have, a system of thought, it is idealist to the extent that, either in itself or as far as we're concerned, it makes knowing the condition of being. That's the key idea. The participatory approach goes, the being of a thing is what informs my knowing. So we start with B, being. So I'm going to do an inquiry into what is a chair? What's chairness? It's got a chair is a material object. It's got a material component to it. You know, the wood or whatever it's made of. It has the form of chairness. It has a formal causal part. It's not tableness. It kind of is an instance of chairness. It's a concrete instance of chairness. It has a what are the other ones? You get your the efficient cause. Somebody made it. You know, if it's IKEA, you finally made it because you just built it. You know, but somebody's put together the parts. You know, there's things that brought the thing physically together. And then there's its final cause, which would be it's designed for something. It has an end, a purpose. So this is the common sense kind of approach to a thing. And so how do we know chairness? We don't go, we start with a chair. I know chairness because I can sense its material. I can pick up and read its form. I've been trained to understand what its purpose is. You know, because sometimes, do you ever have that, when we moved into our house, there was some odd, strange object on the wall that had mercury in it, and we didn't know what it was.
Oh, wow.
It turned out, we think it was some kind of thermostat, but it was, and it was made of Bakelite, like the foreshadower of plastic. But anyway, this is to say, to somebody who, back in 1914, when the house was built or whatever, looked at that, they would understand it's something of its material nature and its form. They'd be able to name what it was, and they'd understand what it was for. Well, some of that information kind of wasn't available to us, as it were. That just shows you. But I could see the thing was there, and that sort of thing. Anyway, so the older non-idealist, what we're going to call realist approach, would start with the thingness of a thing and what it's made of and what it's for, and that informs our knowing. So you start from thing to knowing, and knowing is a way of joining in with the thing, and the thing informing, literally forming your intellect. The idealist goes the other direction. That's what Gilson is saying here. It makes knowing the condition of being. So I start with the how can I know anything, and then I start with doubt, and then I come to the chair, and I don't even ask the question anymore, what's it made of or anything. I'm still stood in front of the chair going, how do I even know it's there? And that, how do I even know it's there, has you just that's produced thousands, tens of thousands of pages of modern and postmodern philosophical speculation on nonsense.
On whether the chair is really there.
Yeah, because it's just decided that you don't even ask anymore. You can't ask what's it made of, what's it for, who put it there, what is chairness? I have to answer that question by saying it's a thing in my head. No. So what we're talking about here, and this comes to the Bible upholds this, is basic, old-fashioned, common-sense realism, rather than the rabbit hole kind of crazy chat of Descartes. Let me just say one more thing, because some folks at the church here are reading through The Consequence of Ideas by R.C. Sproul, which is just brilliant. And anybody who's interested in the stuff we're talking about should go to that book and read through. And we sort of have dinner and chat about it. And we'd just done the chapter on Aquinas, and then you go to Descartes. And you read the Sproul's account of Descartes, and you can experience the philosophical change from the era where everyone was thinking this sort of Thomist Aquinas kind of terms to the Cartesian stuff, because Descartes just turns himself inside out, and it's really hard to follow, not because of Sproul's writing, but because he's thinking about what can I think about. And somebody's likened it to this: Descartes, the guy who burns down the house to find the rats in the attic. In other words, he's so obsessed with that mental itch in his head to try and to try and work out, how can I know anything, that he destroys all of reality to try and find the itch in the head. And if you read Sproul's account, that's, you literally, the existential experience of reading the chapter, you kind of go, actually, I'm not quite, this is quite tricky to follow. Is it me, or is it maybe that Descartes had sent himself bonkers? And I've opted for that option.
Well, there is a sense in which there is so much questioning and skepticism in the pursuit to find real knowledge of anything, and that's what you see in Descartes' thought, that it exposes the underlying assumption that knowledge does genuinely condition being, as you were saying earlier. Instead of being what presents or what is presented to us when we come across a thing. So when we come across the chair, we come across something that conforms to chairness, and that's why we understand it as a chair instead of a cat. It doesn't meow, which is quite a distinguishing feature of catness.
Yes, if you sit on the chair and it meows, it means you didn't spot that the cat was sat on the chair before you sat on the cat. That's right, yeah.
That's it. And there would be debate over that, actually, because if a cat is then mute and cannot do the characteristic meow, has it lost a sense of its catness? That's a question to take home. That's homework. Just bringing some of these thoughts together, I just want to ask a question, Johnny, so that people can really work through this in their minds. When you speak about the difference between knowledge conditioning being and that being problematic, and then the other way around being the more helpful way of understanding things and how we know things and existence and reality and all these questions, What are the problems with that idea? Just state them again for us so people can really understand. What are the problems with that idea of knowledge conditioning being? And why are they resolved when we come to what you understand as an old-fashioned realist perspective?
Well, so the current one, because this is the current debate. And to some extent, it's a bit of a sideshow and distraction from other more important things in the world. Is a woman, or is a woman what I decide a woman is? That's the separation between gender and sex, which is a modern daft dichotomy. Is exactly this denial of the real to come up with a category of mind or social agreement, which is another category of mind. And so you remember we said last time that you can sort of say we are in the Cartesian sense or the Kantian sense, we're stuck in the cell. And so we're deciding what reality's like, and it's our decisions that actually decide what reality is. Well, sometimes we find ourselves in the cell with others and we sort of agree together what reality is. So when you get groups of people deciding that reality is what we've socially constructed it as, what we agree together it is as, or what I personally just intuit and just know, you know, I just know I'm in the wrong body. What's that? That's mind over matter. That's a sense of the real is not the physical, but the real is my personal mental experience, the inner voice, as it were. And so reality then must conform to the idea. That's idealism. It's rampant rationalism, hyper-idealism, which then says then you modify the physical to catch up with the mental construct. And so that is the ultimate expression in our day of knowing conditioning being is mutilating operations on people's sexual organs. That That is... Now, Descartes and Kant never saw that one coming, did they? And actually, to be fair to them, they were realists in this sense. They did believe in a real world. They just didn't know how to access it. But when you have a bad idea set up wrongly, down the line, you get even crazier ideas. And so that's one of the practical reasons. What we're seeing in that debate, the woke debate, is a difference between philosophical realism, or let's call it common sense, and some kind of hyper-rationalism, and others, and rightly said, a kind of Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is that I just know, forget about the world. The world makes no impact on true knowledge. True knowledge is this, that which is intuited and is separate from the world. You know, so again, Gnosticism, hyper-rationalism are similar. They're versions of idealism. And the simple idea here for identifying idealism is, as Gilson says, it's where you make knowing conditioned being.
And there's a way in which the postmodernism that we're confronted with, where people are drawing sharp distinctions between, you know, so-called categories of sex and gender, is just further down. It's the same thought, but further down the trail of that knowledge conditioning being approach that we saw with Descartes and Kant. Because once you open up the possibility of there not being a truth, there not being something to know, you have an assumed skepticism about that question.
Yeah.
Then down the line, it's simply going to come down to total subjectivism in answering the question of what really is reality.
Yeah, and it is the grounds of tyranny. And it's why I think last time we read a bit from 1984, because if you can convince everybody that reality is only what you think in your head, then you stop reality actually contributing to the discussion, and you are left in the tyranny of other people with louder voices imposing their perspective on you. And then you just have to go with that perspective. And if that perspective happens to be pressed on you by people in power over you, which is what 1984 is exploring, so the government tells you what history is, and you just are left going, well, I can't possibly know, because we can't know anything, can we? You end up looking to some other authority to be your guarantor or your guarantee of truth. And so, which is why I think, you know, there are what comes with the woke agenda and the knowing shaping being that's going on in there is a kind of totalitarian approach, isn't it? It's like you get thought policing. Which, you know, your language is an expression of your thoughts, so your language needs policing. You can get done for wrong think, and ultimately, if I think wrongly about somebody else, if I misgender somebody, it's because I'm thinking wrongly about them, and because thinking is the main thing, then I've somehow harmed them. So then you get so you end up with everyone deeply self-censoring themselves. It ends up with a kind of a personal tyranny, and because reality is no longer contributing to the discussion anymore, it's just a fight between people's perspectives.
And this is the type of thinking, this denial of reality, this subjective approach to knowledge, that's completely contrary to the scriptures. And
yeah.
This is what we wanted to get into a little bit when kind of recording this episode, because if you look at the Bible, and we can't spend loads of time on this, but it's just an out there assumption that there is knowledge to be gained about the world, about God, and you do know these things when they impose themselves on you. Think about 2 Corinthians 4:18. This is a really interesting verse to contemplate about. Think about 2 Corinthians 4:18 reads, "While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. This is a really interesting verse, because if you look at the assumption, Paul isn't saying the things which are seen are not real, they are illusions. No, he's saying the things which are seen are temporary. So they are seen because they are real, but they are temporary. But the things which are not seen, the eternal realities, are eternal. They are real and eternal, and they will not pass away. And there's a real sense in which, for the Christian, we must approach the world as real. And when we come to it, when we come to the light of nature, as our confession says, that's the world, that's creation, that's God's providence in history. And then when we come to the Holy Scriptures, the special revelation of God in Jesus Christ and in the word enlettered, we are coming to reality. And in coming to those things, we are actually coming to knowledge of God. That if we think right back to the beginning, we are coming to a genuine relationship in, with, and to God, reality himself.
Yeah, I think so. So that 2 Corinthians 4 passage, I mean, part of what's going on here is Paul's considering, well, let's look a few verses back up, chapter 4, verse 7. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair. Dropping down just the previous verse of the one you read. So we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is prepared for us, has prepared for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. There's a fascinating thing here that Paul's very aware of the reality of the world. He's going through, he talks about being in physical suffering and struggle and affliction. So there's very much a real world here. But the affliction and the experience of affliction lifts his eyes from the seen to the unseen. Now that, and so to the eternal and to the divine. Now that's what's also going on in Romans 1. Romans 1 is the famous passage that talks about the divine, the nature of divinity, the nature of God as all-powerful and good and those sorts of things is available to us through creation. Creation speaks those things and we are culpable because we've kind of received that. So in this life, before we come before God, we know God through things and through experiences. We know him as, and this is the confession, as a 17th century doctrine document, is articulates the old realist position in chapter 1, as you've quoted it. It talks about how we can know God through creation and the light of nature, that nature displays God. We know God in and through things, but we don't know him savingly that way. We know him savingly through his ultimately through Christ, which words and events which are then inscripturated by the Holy Spirit. So but even there we know God in and through things. You think about just the teaching ministry of the church. I think, is it Sinclair Ferguson, I think, once said somewhere, it always stuck with me, that God, do you know what God sounds like to your congregation? God sounds like the voice of your pastor. So for Sinclair Ferguson, God sounded Scottish to people because God speaks to us through things and through people and through ink on a page, through the very interaction with the real world and real people. And then when we come face to face with him, Aquinas thought lots about the beatific vision, God's essence, who God is, will directly inform our intellect. So we will know as we are known. And what does that mean? Who knows? But right now, the reality of the world is a means of communication of God to us. And in providence, because the confession also talks about creation and providence, and Paul here in 2 Corinthians 4 is reading providence, isn't he? He's going, that I'm going through things, and these afflictions are means by which God is pointing me beyond the things as sign to the things signified. And that's the basis of realism in the end, that our created world, our ability to use language and symbols are all backed up by that which they, the unseen, which speaks to us through the seen, through general revelation and special revelation. And that's why we have to be realists rather than what you could call idealists.
Absolutely. Well, that's all we have time for now, unfortunately. Time has gone so quickly. Thank you for all of you who've tuned into this episode. I hope that it's been thought-provoking for you, and do send in any questions if you have them, and we'll either think about them ourselves and give an answer, or we'll bring someone in who we think would be better informed to answer the question, and we'll get them to answer it. So please do send in any questions and tune in to our next episode next week. Thanks again, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.